Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Michael Newton Brown, a man of many talents. Listen to how a man who comes from a family that doesn't know from theater becomes someone who does everything in theater. Stay tuned. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. It's about recognizing that unfortunately so many of us have had experiences in our childhood which forced us to deny significant, important aspects of ourselves, skills that we would have developed and enjoyed using in our lives, ways of being that just didn't work somehow in our family of origin or in the school that we went to or were unacceptable to the culture we lived in or even the religious organization we belonged to. And so these qualities, these aspects, these skills, when they showed themselves, they got criticism or neglect or sometimes even abuse. And we learned to deny these aspects of ourselves. This can be anything like our enjoyment of dancing or singing, to our ability to be independent or to stand up for ourselves or even to be safe or healthy. Obviously, it is preferable if we are able to have access to the skills that we feel naturally drawn to, or to be the person we were naturally born as. And obviously, it is preferable for us to feel safe and be able to be healthy. If for any reason you were denied this gift, you were discouraged from having some of these things that actually belong to you, and unfortunately, this happens more often than we are aware in this culture, because once you've denied it, you do such a good job of denying it that you forget it. However, there's always the lingering sense that something is missing, something is wrong. And in order to demonstrate what it sounds like when you are your whole self, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And when you listen to them, at least in the aspect of their work, you can hear what it sounds like to be what we therapists call congruent.
Michael's story is really interesting, not only because it's the story of a man who comes from a very unlikely theater background and somehow manages to use his creativity and his cleverness to pursue what he wants, even in the face of what his family seems to want him to be. But also because Michael came of age in a particular time in our history when there was a lot of turmoil, and Michael seemed to be in the middle of it, although not by choice. Michael seems actually to have witnessed and been in an ironic way a part of a very tumultuous time in our history.
But I will let Michael tell it himself. So here now, Michael Newton Brown. So I am here with Michael Newton Brown. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And that does describe you, does it not?
Pretty much.
Good. Okay, so the art that you and I are talking about right now is director for theater, but that's not the only art that you have spent your life doing. Am I correct?
No, I'm a director, I'm a scenic designer, and I'm a lighting designer.
Aha!
As well.
Right. All of the things that are necessary to make the theater happen, right?
All the things that are necessary to keep you working in the business in one form or another.
Or another. Very nice. Very clever. Okay. So the question I ask is, when did it occur to you that theater was interesting, that designing was interesting, that color or story or... do you remember?
My dad tells me that he took me to the senior class play. He was a teacher. And I was just a little kid, and not even in elementary school yet. And they did Ten Little Indians. And he said, I spoke of nothing for 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. Now, see, I don't remember that.
No.
But that's what he told me. And then my family, again, my family, we traveled in the summer, and we would go to New York. And I remember my first Broadway musical was Gwen Verdon in Damn Yankees, and I was 7 years old.
Uh-huh.
And all I can remember is the front curtain was all baseballs.
Uh-huh.
And I knew then, I fell in love with New York City. I said, this is where I belong.
At seven.
At like that, yeah.
Right, right.
My first professional show was in Summer Stock at 12.
I was going to say, no, don't get ahead, but you didn't get ahead. So how did you get from 7 to a first professional show at 12?
Well,
did you say to your parents, this is what I want, I have to have lessons, or?
I knew. I just knew. And we had the old Flat Rock, we had a summer place in North Carolina, Hendersonville, and the Flat Rock Playhouse is up there that's been there forever, Equity Professional House. And I started taking courses in children's theater. And then they cast me as small role in one of the shows. So that was my first professional production. I was 12 years old.
Wow.
And then I went through all the drama club and everything in high school. And we're
so now you're an actor, right? I mean, that's
that's how most everybody starts.
I know, right.
You know? But even then, I was watching the scenery, and I was watching the production. And
you remember the baseballs. That's what
I remember the baseballs.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And then I did drama school, drama in thespians in high school, and all of that, and president of the drama club, and where all my friends got their sweaters with their letters in football and whatever else. I got mine in theater. I got all my points doing it in theater, and. I learned then I didn't want to be an actor because I really liked having my fingers in all those other little pies. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I like creating the product.
Okay, wait a second. Hold on. I'm interested that you said all my friends got letters in sports and I got it in theater this is interesting to me because it suggests that you had friends across the board, that mm-hmm. you had friends who were jocks, you had friends who were whatever, but is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
My father was the track coach. My father is the ultimate jock.
Wow.
And they won all kinds of state awards and everything, and I used to do trapeze because I almost went circus. But I had a trapeze in the backyard, and that's how I worked out, is on the trapeze, and I could do ankle catches and heel catches and back layouts, and I could
goodness.
Do all that. But the story is, because of that, my father decided that I would be a good pole vaulter because I could do the trapeze stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he put me out there in the field with this pole in my hand, and nobody to tell me how to do it.
Run
down, stick the pole in that box, and go over the thing, and land in the sawdust. Do you know how nasty sawdust in your jock strap is?
Oh, please.
No, not doing that. This is not for me. So I was a huge disappointment.
It's a real stretch who you became coming from there.
My family was not that at all. The point I was trying to make was, on those summer trips, because my father taught history and was a historian, I was dragged to every Civil War battlefield in the United States. Every ravine, every hill, every tree. And I have a wonderful appreciation of history. I love history.
Yeah.
I love museums.
Mm-hmm.
I love all of that. I love art museums. So they did instill in me.
It's ironic. And the other thing that's ironic to me is that given who your father was and what he might have wanted you to be, that he told you that thing about your first experience in theater and how you wouldn't talk about anything else. He might not have told you that. Do you know what I mean? So so he encouraged you in an interesting way.
He did. He said, you know,
he let you be, kind of.
He let me be.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There was one summer he didn't. It was after that summer of stock, and I wanted to go back to that theater again that summer. And he says, no, you've experienced that. This summer, you're going to learn to play golf. God, was that a disaster. Then one summer, I took art. That was cool.
So you've got this childhood in which you essentially decide at the beginning where you want to spend your life, that you want to be in the theater somehow. And then you do the best that you can with what control you have over your own life
mm-hmm.
to explore that in school and right, and then you take as many summers as they'll give you to, right? Okay. And then you graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens?
I went to Boston University.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, and they still have, a very, very reputable theater program. And I spent 4 years at BU.
And majoring in theater.
Director. You could major directing, designing, acting. And I went in as a director. And so the first 2 years, I was doing all kinds of production stuff. They make you do that. And I had incredible acting classes. And then junior and senior year, I started getting gigs that other people were not getting. And I was asked to stage for the opera. No undergraduate was ever asked to stage manage for the opera. That was a graduate director gig. And I was getting gigs like that. And then they did a big musical every year. BU was not a musical school. It's more serious. But they did a big musical, and I was asked to stage manage the big musical. And there was some flack about that. But
from whom? Other students?
Yeah. Grad students were not pleased. Because they didn't get to do it because, you know, they needed it for the credit.
Right.
But I didn't have anything to do with it. They just asked me to do it. And then I think the most interesting thing about the Boston University experience is it was senior year, 1970, and in the spring of 1970 was Kent State
mm-hmm.
and the Vietnam War, and then Jackson State. And our school, BU is an urban campus, so it's not like It's along streets in the city. And our school happened to be by the National Guard Armory. And people were rioting and throwing Molotov cocktails. And we woke up one morning in May, I guess it was, and we were told go home.
Because it's too dangerous.
And, I mean, and then we were told, you'll be graded on whatever you've done in this semester. There will be no exams. Go home. Go home now.
Oh, my goodness.
School is closed. And we didn't get to see everybody to say goodbye.
Oh, it was the end.
Bam. Cut off.
Oh, my God.
And a few of us were able to get together in a professor's apartment and have a little party and say goodbye.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And then we were doing a show then that was going to be going to the National College Theater Festival in Washington. We went down there and performed at the festival. However, that was during the last big peace march. We were tear gassed. We came out of a restaurant eating and looked down the street, and here they came down the street with the cops after them, and we went right back in the door of that restaurant, and they locked the door of the restaurant.
Well, so you were right in the middle of that.
I was in the middle
of all
that.
Even though you were not in the middle of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You were collateral damage.
Sort of, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also one of those naked people waving at you from the reflection pond. So it was exciting times.
It was.
It was exciting time there.
Well, yeah. So you're out of school.
Yeah.
Bang, bang.
And I had applied to Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown College, mm-hmm. back to the circus, thinking I could meet somebody who could teach me circus. And anyway, I got accepted. And this is, again, 1970. And there were 3,000 applicants then, and they accepted 30 people, and I was one of them.
Wow.
And I went through 8 weeks of hardcore basic training, circus training, down here in Venice at the old arena, mm-hmm. and got a contract on the Red Show. And I went on the Red Show for a year.
That's what is Gunter the Gable. Red Show?
They had three shows. Well, then they had two shows, the Red Show and the Blue Show. They alternated routes. They had two shows out.
Ah.
The Red Show was with Gunter Gable Williams. Mm-hmm. And I was on the road for a year with the Red Show.
Did you like it?
No.
Ah.
No, I didn't. It was really a learning experience. I've never been so lonely in the midst of a group of people in my life.
Because you're not really a circus person?
Because it's very stratified.
Really?
Well, Ringling. Right. Was very, because Ringling is huge and very corporate. And the smaller shows are more family-oriented.
Right.
But the Bulgarians hang with the Bulgarians, the Hungarians hang with the Hungarians.
Really?
The animal people hang with animal people, aerialists with aerialists. And as a clown, you're like way towards the bottom of the social ladder, just above the showgirls.
Wow.
And not a lot of cross...
Pollination
between that. And then, you know, you had the workers as well. So I had about three good friends who were also clowns on the show. And I learned that that wasn't for me.
Wow. A lot of experiences that you had to learn what was not for you.
Oh, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the... Most of my best learning experiences has been what not to
what
do.
What not to do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know. And
so, what are you now, about 22, 24, something like that?
21, 22.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the show, I went back to New York. I got my equity card. I went to New York, so I was not going to go back in that town without my union card for theater. And I met someone and fell in love, and... That someone had mutual friends who had been doing hair. Mm-hmm. Hair was still a big deal,
mm-hmm.
then. And they had been staging it in the country, different companies. Because in this country, they didn't tour so much. They had the Boston company, the LA company, the Detroit company. And they were putting those together. And then they got the gig for Scandinavia. And they'd been in Scandinavia for about a year and a half. And they called Jimmy to come over. And be a company manager. And as soon as he could, Jimmy got me over there. And I didn't know what I was going to wind up doing. I thought I was going to be doing hair. But Superstar had just, Jesus Christ Superstar had just opened in New York and was this smash. They got the rights. And I got over there, and they had just opened a Superstar in Copenhagen. And then we were going to go join what's the equivalent of the national tour in Örebro, Sweden, which was somewhere north of the Arctic Circle.
Oh, no.
Yeah, in ice halls.
Oh, and, God.
I know. And so I wind up there. Here I am. And I'm running a light board.
Mm-hmm.
And the lighting designer, this will come out later, the lighting designer for that had been Jewel Fisher's assistant on Broadway for the lighting design for Jesus Christ Superstar.
I was so, wondering what he was doing in the ice.
Yeah, as were we all. Anyway, the crew was Swedish, Norwegian, Czechoslovakian, and, well, there's another one in there, maybe German. And so the stage manager would give the setup for a cue, and then you hear it translated over the headsets, and everybody knew the word go.
Oh, how funny. That's great.
Oh, it's really funny.
That's great.
It was really funny. And so after that, lived in Europe, made a ton of money, lived in Europe, waiting for these producers to get their act together for the show to go to Norway. And had a flat in London for about 6 weeks. And then we had friends in Athens, Greece. So we went down to Karnelis' place in Athens, which was just down the hill from the Parthenon. Mm.
So this career has helped you to see the world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and we stayed in the old family villa.
Oh.
And we were there for 6 or 8 weeks. Mm. It was so it was during Papadopoulos' regime. Very interesting. We were warned by our friends, don't talk politics to anyone, don't talk politics to cab drivers, people disappear off the streets.
Oh my God.
Be a dumb tourist. Yeah. And they wouldn't talk to us until we went, like, out of the city to a beach where we could sit on a hill overlooking the beach.
And see if there was anyone around.
Only then would they talk to us.
Wow.
Because they were very anti-Papadopoulos. And there were gun turrets, manned gun turrets. But Athens was so safe.
Yes, you know. I bet it was.
Yeah, because we were, the Acropolis is just, like, a big hill.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on one side of this Plaka, which is the old Athens. And then we were over the hill in whatever this neighborhood was. And you could eat dinner or go to the bars, whatever. And you could be coming home any hour of the day or night. And it was absolutely safe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you give and you get, right?
You give and you get, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So came back to New York after that and did a couple off-Broadway shows, stage managing a couple off-Broadway shows and some summer stock, and then I get this phone call from this guy who was the lighting guy in Sweden. He's back in the States. He's formed his own lighting design company, and his first big gig is a young lady named Bette Midler who just had a big hit with Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy tour. And it was out in L.A., and he couldn't do it because he got a Beach Boys gig, and would I come out and take over lighting that tour? Sure. So I went out and brought the show back to Broadway,
mm-hmm.
One Night Stands. Now, that was interesting, because she had just done that famous Carson show,
yes. Mm-hmm.
First time she was on Carson. And they had tried to get her to come on, and she refused to come on unless she could bring her band and her girls and do it her way. And finally they relented. And that was the night America discovered Bette Midler.
Yeah, the Divine Miss M.
The Divine Miss M. They taught me the show in San Francisco, and the next gig was something like Phoenix. And I looked out at the audience, and I thought, they're going to kill us. They're going to kill us. Because the mix was the most amazing thing. You had these families, the grandparents, the parents, and a couple little kids sitting next to two drag queens in gold and silver lame. And that is the dichotomy of what this audience was. And you'd have a drag queen coming down the aisles in roller skates dressed as a bride. And you know, and you could hear a pin drop in this audience because you know they were all absolutely scared to death of each other.
Right.
And I look, this happened night after night. You know, Phoenix, Albuquerque, down. I'm going, oh, jeez. But she would walk out on that stage. The band would come out. Manilow was her musical director. Bette would come out with slacks, a white blouse, two white fans, 2 minutes standing ovation.
Really?
Yeah. And she'd finally have to say, shut up, sit down, I ain't done nothing yet. And they would. And by the end of the show, the end of the evening, they were dancing together. It was just, I can only imagine all the stories about Garland.
Mm-hmm. How she crossed the lines,
What she was, because I would stand there in the wings, and I'm seeing it every night in a different theater, and it's just, it was incredible to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of Manilow's biggest gifts is producing a show. He is consummate artist when it comes to putting together a music show.
In what way?
He knows what works.
Ah.
He knows how to make it work musically. He knows how to line up the songs. He knows how to work the emotions.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really brilliant. Brilliant.
So he wrote it?
Well,
essentially, in collaboration with her.
With her, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah. And Bruce Valanche, do you know Bruce Valanche?
I do not.
Bruce Valanche, there's a wonderful documentary you should see called Get Bruce. He was a writer in Chicago, newspaper writer in Chicago. Funny man. And he started writing for Bette. And he's written the Academy Awards, he's written the Emmys, he's written all these. And to hear Whoopi Goldberg and all these comedians talk about Bruce Valanche, he took Harvey Fierstein's place on Broadway in Hairspray as Edna, did it for 2 years. And I would be in the dressing room, and Bruce would just be there talking, and Bruce is the funniest thing in the world. Just one thing comes out of his mouth after another. And Bette's getting ready, putting on her makeup. She goes out on stage, and there's all this stuff that Bruce was doing.
She's using it.
She's using it.
Mm-hmm.
She's using it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, crazy. Then she had this hit. We wound up at the Palace on Broadway for Christmas, and she took a break, and Manilow was going out because he just had his first album, Mandy,
mm-hmm.
and I write the songs, mm-hmm. and he was going out and playing the clubs, the music rooms, to promote it, and asked me to go with him. And I was with that for 3 years, and from leaky pipe basement music rooms all around the country, I saw us go to 17,000 seat arenas.
Wow.
And huge outdoor music festivals and Broadway again.
Wow.
Yeah. So now how old are we?
Yes. What's interesting about this is that you went, essentially, you went from virtually nothing to everything in a very short period. I mean, it was a huge leap. You sort of leapfrogged over a number of steps, kind of like what you did in school, where you shouldn't have been the stage manager for the opera or for the musical, but you sort of leapfrogged over the...
It did.
Right?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
And when I had time off, I'd be back in New York in the summer directing something off Broadway, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was trying to make the transition to Broadway, and it was difficult. And I was also being a lighting designer. Now I was being known as a lighting designer for rock and roll, which was verboten then.
Yeah.
That was a whole other thing. Broadway didn't want
didn't
to know,
want to from, know
that.
From that yet.
They, not
right.
want
they
to
didn't
know from
get
that.
It yet.
They didn't get it. And my oldest best friend, I told you about it during the wedding, he was production manager for opera companies. So when I came off the road, Barry, I guess, he said, come to the Providence Opera and do Light This Opera. And I said, Scotty, I don't know the first thing about lighting opera. He said, yes, you do. It's a long, slow musical. I said, oh, okay, I can do that. So I learned how to light opera, and I was lighting opera all over the country. And then...
Is that an entree into Broadway when rock and roll is... No, that isn't either.
That's
no,
its
no,
own...
No. It's yeah, right.
Its own,
right.
beast. It's its own separate beast.
Right, right.
And I had started in 76 coming back to Florida because I had gotten... New York was trying to pigeonhole me.
Well.
Are you a director? Are you a lighting designer? What are you?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I can do
yes.
all. Yes. Yes to all of that.
Yes.
And they couldn't handle that.
Yeah.
And my family was, I'm from Clearwater. I'm like fourth generation Floridian.
Ah, I didn't realize that.
So my family's down here getting older. I started coming back more to help them. And between 76 and 80, it would be a month in Florida, 2 months in New York, 2 months in Florida, 1 month in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working down here.
Oh.
And people were happy to have me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't being pigeonholed.
Mm-hmm.
So
and they were glad that you had all these skills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And by 80, I had moved pretty much back. And there was a huge, in Tampa Bay, professional theater scene. Excuse me. Dinner theater. But if you want to work in Florida,
mm-hmm.
that's what you did. So I worked constantly. And then I was, because of the lighting, I was getting regional theaters, Coconut Grove Playhouse in Miami, Burt Reynolds Theater when he
mm-hmm.
had it,
yeah.
Syracuse Stage, and I met a director who liked my work, and he was been working on a project called Jerry's Girls, which is the music of Jerry Herman.
Mm.
And they had been working it, and he asked me to come light, to meet Jerry Herman in Key West, and then, depending upon how that went, to light the national tour.
Right, right.
With Carol Channing, Leslie Uggams, and Andre McArdle.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so I got the gig. I did it. It was supposed to go to Broadway. But Miss Channing could not stand this director. And she refused to go as long as he was directing the show. Well, she didn't own the show. He did.
He did. I was just going to
say,
right.
Anyway, that's sort of a long story. But I did that. And I got Disney on Ice. I did a Disney on Ice show. I did a big ice show at Busch Gardens that ran for 5 years. And I wound up doing less and less of the road because I didn't... I'd done it for like 5 years.
Yeah,
you
really?
Know, one-nighters. In it, 5 years. And going out and doing the opera, it would be 10 days, but 10 very lonely days because my schedule was very different from their schedule and... It started off really easy for me, and then towards the end, it got really, really intense and difficult. So I didn't have time to socialize very much.
Yeah,
I spent
no.
a lot of time in a hotel, and I didn't like that
no.
so much. I didn't like that so much. So I've done less, much, much less of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I was working more down here.
Yeah, and there is work here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Oh,
okay.
I love this town. I love this town, Sarasota.
Yeah.
Great
well,
town.
It is.
Don't tell
I know,
him.
I know. Currently, you are directing Cabaret for the Players. Now, I know that Cabaret is a play that means a lot to you.
Yeah,
I know
it
that.
Does.
Right. And I know that you know a lot about it. So, just to start, give us an overview of what the play is about, and then just say whatever it is that comes to mind.
I can let people know what my age is by telling you that I saw the very first public preview of Cabaret in Boston in 1966.
My goodness.
When it was in tryouts before it went to New York. And it was a pretty affecting show then. And I went back 6 weeks later as it was closing before it went to New York to see what the changes were in it. What's very interesting that I did not know at the time was that Hal Prince, who was the director and who conceived Cabaret, was likening it unto America at that particular time, where America's head was at with race relations and everything else. And how that might blow up and affect this country the way that the Nazis took over in Germany. Interesting concept.
Oh, my God. Wow. So he was attempting to caution us.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Mm-hmm. So you want to say a little bit about the content of the play?
It's based on Christopher Isherwood's writings, Berlin Stories, who was a British writer who went to Berlin for the freedom that Berlin was mm-hmm. at the time because he was gay. And he was a published writer and starting to be known. And his sexual tendencies could not enter into any of his writings. Remember, this is 1929. And he wrote privately about his life in diaries, but it was never, ever published. But he did write some different stories. And one of them was about this lady named Sally Bowles. And a British producer decided to make a movie called I Am a Camera, which is a quote from what Christopher Isherwood considered himself to be. And this movie was about Sally Bowles. And they had to make Cliff, the man who was visiting Berlin, who was Christopher Isherwood, the love interest.
Ah.
So Cliff became a straight man in the film, henceforth in the play. Henceforth in 1966, when they were turning it into a musical, you still had to have, Cliff had to be straight.
Yeah.
Little hints of what possibly might be going on. But the interesting thing about Cabaret is the Cabaret that was done in 1966 is different from the Cabaret that was revived in 1984, is different from the Cabaret that Sam Mendes reimagined in 1998 at the Dahmer Warehouse in London, which became a huge hit that was brought to Studio 54 with Alan Cumming's. And is now that revival is being revived.
Good grief.
Because our society has changed.
What we will tolerate.
What we will tolerate and what is accepted. So Cabaret has changed over the years.
So can you just say how, in what way it's changed?
In what we can show on stage. I mean, it was a very, very decadent period in Germany during the Weimar Republic because people had lost all hope. They were devastated by World War I. Their money was worth nothing. Inflation was 1,000%. No one had work. On the streets, you would see the veterans of World War I on crutches and with limbs gone because they really had no veteran support kind of thing. It was very, very, very depressing. And people pretty much put their heads in the sand because they didn't know what to do. They just didn't know what to do. And many people, in putting their heads in the sand, just turned to what we would call drug, sex, and rock and roll
mm-hmm.
and partied down. And Berlin was the most interesting place to be in Western Europe then because it was wide open. Artists, writers from all over were coming there, and it was sleazy and tawdry, but it was a very exciting place to be as well at that time. And there were several political parties vying to get control. The Weimar Republic was their first attempt at democracy, and it was sort of falling apart. And as people weren't paying attention, the Nazi Party just slipped in and took over.
Oh, I see.
So this cabaret takes place in a cabaret, and it leads up to the takeover.
Wow.
And tells these people's lives, stories.
Okay, so which version are you doing? Or are you not doing one of the versions?
That's a good answer.
You're doing the Michael Newton Brown version?
I'm doing the Michael Newton Brown version. I am.
Yeah?
Yeah. And I think it's going to be very interesting. The most interesting couple to me in the show is the elderly couple. Herr Schultz, who runs a fruit stand, has fallen in love with Frau Schneider, who runs the boarding house. And they're both elderly, and he said, why should we be alone? We should be together. And she says, yes, we should be together. Until a good friend of hers, who is a Nazi sympathizer, comes to her and says, I advise you not to do this for your own good. And she says, but he's German. He's German. No, he's not German. So she has to stop the relationship.
He's not German, meaning that he's Jewish.
Meaning that he's Jewish.
Right.
So, I mean, we deal with racism here.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, all of the scenes that carry the story are really well-written plays, book scenes. They have a little bit of music in it. But when you go back to the cabaret performances comment on what just happened in that scene.
Wow.
Satirically.
Really?
Or whatever other way. But it comments on what just happened.
That's fascinating.
Oh, it's fascinating. It's so well written. It's so well written. And I'm doing what I always wanted to do with the piece, is I want it to completely take place in the cabaret. We don't go to various places as it did in the original and then come back to the cabaret. We stay in the cabaret.
So you can do, for example, the interaction between the elderly couple even in the cabaret.
On the cabaret stage, we have 6 or 7 chairs that are moved around in different positions, and they become Cliff's room,
yes,
or they become Frau Schneider's living room. And all of that is done very minimally, and the stories are told.
So because it's about the stories.
It's about the stories.
Yeah.
But we never, ever leave the cabaret.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Okay, so have you directed this before?
No, I've wanted to all my life. All my adult life. It's my first chance I've had to do it.
This is wonderful.
So this has been percolating in my head for a very, very, very long time.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing and wonderful. So just... is there anything else you want to say about this play?
I don't want to give it away.
I mean, okay.
We're doing our own take on cabaret, which is not like any other take on cabaret you may have ever seen.
Mm-hmm. So if you've seen the play, if you've seen the movie, you haven't seen...
We are not the movie.
That's right.
We are not the movie at all.
Right. So, okay, I'm quite sure that this has titillated...
I hope so.
Yeah.
Titillated is a really good word.
This particular really good show. Right?
Oh, even my cabaret girls are terrific, because that's more like what they would have been like back then. It's not a line of pretty thin showgirls. I have a thin, fat chorus line.
Oh, my God.
Of women who aren't ever quite together.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Which is just the way it would have been.
Yes, right. You know? Right. They weren't the Rockettes.
No, they weren't the Rockettes. And it was all kind of tawdry,
yeah,
you know, and I'm not negating any of that.
Wow. Well, okay, you heard it here first. Come on out and see Cabaret beginning on January 8th.
Yeah.
Is that the preview or is that the opening?
That's
the
opening.
Know?
That's
okay.
The opening.
Great.
Previews are 2 nights before.
All right. Okay, so now I always ask as the sort of final question, when someone has given a life... as you actually have, I mean, pretty much your entire life, as much as you have had control over, you have dedicated to the theater in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult path to choose in the world that we live in. So do you have anything that you would want to say about what it was like so far to have dedicated an entire life to various aspects of the theater?
I've always felt that I was blessed. I was very lucky. I was given the talents to create magic, and it comes back to me in the most surprising ways that somebody will come up to me and say, you touched me. Mm-hmm. 30 years ago. And you influenced my decisions on many things 30 years ago.
Oh, my God.
And I have a young lady I work with now who is incredibly talented. And her mama had to remind me that I had directed her when she was 12 years old in a performing arts group in St. Pete.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't regret anything. I sometimes regret I didn't stay in New York, but you can't regret. I came to Florida, and...
It's given you a very nice life.
It's given me a very nice life. Money isn't everything. Mm-hmm. I have wonderful friends, and I'm respected by my peers, right, which is the greatest gift.
Yes.
It doesn't matter how many awards you're nominated for or win. It's to have the respect of your peers.
Yes.
So no, I can't regret anything.
No, it's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Michael.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Money isn't everything, and I don't regret a thing. What a wonderful thing to be able to say about your life. I believe that I was lucky. I was blessed. I was given something that I can give away that gives back to me. Wow. Would that we all could say that about our lives. And of course, you know that I believe that we can all say that about our lives if we are fortunate enough to have been able to do what Michael did. I don't know how much of this you remember from the interview, but Michael's father was a high school track teacher. Definitely no theater in his family. No artistic bent. However, Michael's father made a point to tell him of his attachment to something he saw when he was quite young, to say over and over again, boy, you talked about that for weeks. And then there's his experience at 7 years old. He still remembers the baseballs on the curtain. He knew so young that art, theater, New York, drama, stories, these were the things that drew him. And so although he agreed to learn golf, although he let his dad give him a pole vault, right? He endured it all. But underneath, he held tight to his certainty of who he is. And he used every opportunity. He studied it in school. He pursued it in college. Never mind that his college was cut short. Never mind all of the obstacles that seemed to stand in his way. He stayed true to Michael. And that, of course, is the message of the Lynn Show, the theme of the Lynn Show, the point of the Lynn Show, that it's not what other people say you should be. It's who you are that is important. So, yes, we all have to conform to some extent, but we can all do more of who we really are and less of what the conventions say we must be, what our parents thought was right, what our teachers said we had to believe, what our friends approve of. There's someone in there who you may not be aware of, in touch with, and therefore able to honor. But when you can do that, then you can say, as Michael has said, I have no regrets. I am aware of what is important, and it isn't money, and it isn't even fame. For Michael, it is the respect of his peers, and the fact that he knows that he does magic, and that he touches other human beings. And that he can do that with a skill which essentially he came in with. So, I hope that Michael's story has motivated you to look inside and see if maybe there's somebody in there that you have been denying, that you can say hello to and begin the process of exploring, accessing, and therefore enjoying. And you know, I cannot remember, so if I didn't already say, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, don't leave the E out of Lynn, in thelynnshow.com. And if you want to talk about this, you can email me. There's a link to email me, and I'll be happy to talk to you about it. You can listen to not only this interview on my website, but all the interviews that I have ever done.
Okay, we're going to go out on the title tune from the musical Cabaret, which is, of course, Cabaret. And
I am hoping, as always, that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that turned you on, something you didn't know that you now know, something that you knew but had forgotten, something that made you think or laugh or smile or something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I always hope you will be too.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine. Come hear the band. Come blow your horn. Start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. No use permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away. Come to the cabaret. I used to have a girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea. She wasn't what you'd call a blushing flower. As a matter of fact, she rented by the hour. The day she died, the neighbors came to snicker. Well, that's what comes of too much pills and liquor. But when I saw her laid out like a queen, she was the happiest corpse I'd ever seen. I think of Elsie to this very day. I remember how she turned to me and said, what good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. And as for me, I made my mind up back in Chelsea. start by admitting from cradle to tomb. Isn't that long a stay? Life is a cabaret, old chum. Only a cabaret, old chum. And I love a cabaret.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang.